thanks a lot for the invitation. So I'm just going to discuss about three ideas, basically, on how you can sort of like probe new parameter space in for dark matter in direct detection. So basically, I'm going to discuss about the prospects of detecting bound dark matter in detectors. I'll mention very briefly the idea of inelastic scattering, because yesterday Joseph discussed about this very extensively. And then I'm going to discuss a little bit about the shadowing effect of the Earth and how this can affect direct detection. Okay. So let me start with the first one that has to do with the prospects of detection of dark matter that is gravitationally bound to the Earth. So in fact, dark matter can be captured by the Earth and later can recoil on detectors. So in order to figure out actually what is the probability of having a situation like this, first you need to calculate the capture rate. And I mean, you don't need to pay attention to the formula. I mean, all I want to point out is that, of course, it depends on the mass of the Earth, the cross section, and then you can get a differential rate with respect to the eccentricity of the elliptic orbit that you capture the particle, and the perihelion. The second thing you need to know is like for how long you can accumulate particles in orbits. So the idea here is like, you capture a particle, and then this particle goes in and out from the Earth. If it scatters once more, we completely ignore this particle. Okay, so we consider only particles that they get captured, and then the second time they interact is in the detector. Okay, so for this one, you need to figure out the mean free path. But then, of course, there's also an upper bound on the accumulation time, which is the age of the Earth. And finally, you can just calculate the rate of events for non-directional or also for directional detectors. Now, the point here is that you will see that there are three places where the cross-section between dark matter and nucleon enters in this problem. The first one is in the capture rate, which is proportional to sigma, of course. The higher the cross-section, the higher the probability of getting captured. It enters inversely proportional, actually, in the accumulation time, because the larger the cross-section, the smaller the time that it's going to take before you scatter again. So, in fact, smaller cross-sections actually can accumulate for longer times. And, of course, it enters again in this constant here, which is simply the fact that you want it to interact once more at your detector. So, basically, the overall, I would say, like, roughly, behavior is that this thing behaves as proportional to sigma. So this is very important because it always comes at the same sort of like proportionality with the halo, with the direct sort of like halo dark matter detection. So it's basically quite cross-section independent. So what I did with Ricardo Catena is like we went through like several of these sort of like effective operators. And we calculated actually, this is the ratio of events at a very ridiculously low recoil energy of 1 eV. So this is impossible at the moment, but this is actually how the ratio of events of bound dark matter over actually direct halo dark matter would look like as a function of the dark matter mass. This is the usual sort of like spin independent. This green one here is like, which is proportional to Q squared over V squared, is like operators like O11, O7. They all give behaviors like that. And you can see, in fact, that you can get actually ratios almost like 400 times actually larger than the regular sort of like halo dark matter. And this is exactly the same picture, actually, but now this is the rate of events as a function of the recoil energy. And then you see, again, for the spin independent, you get a small bump, actually, as you go roughly at 10 eV. If you get one of these sort of like Q squared over V squared operators, then you get two distinct actually peaks. So One corresponds to the direct, sort of like direct detection halo dark matter. And the other one, the lower one here, corresponds to the bound dark matter. Of course, this is low energy, but on the other hand, I mean, this is like 400 times more events than halo dark matter in this region here. And also, like I mentioned, I mean, this effect is independent of the cross section. So this picture, actually, once you have like an operator like this, is going to show up with a sort of like a same relevant sort of like ratio. And in principle, it can actually be helpful to penetrate the neutrino flow, because this is a feature that, if you have like an interaction like this, this is a feature that you wouldn't expect to see, like this double peak actually in neutrinos. But on the other hand, I mean, and also this is important in order to identify the type of interaction, because you can see the behavior between like different operators gives you different sort of like peaks here. And on the other hand, the point is that you really have to go to low experimental energy threshold. So these are some sort of like dummies sitting somewhere here, I think. There are some proposals that they, in principle, they can lie in this region here. So this is something that could be quite important, because this is a universal feature, and the point is that it is independent of the dark matter nucleon cross section. Okay.
Chris,
yes.
What is this 400 larger rate?
So this means that if you're looking actually, if you had a detector and was looking at a beam at this sort of like very energy range here, you would get like 400 more events from bound dark matter, okay, rather than sort of like the usual halo dark matter. Okay. Yeah. So the second thing I wanted to mention is just like an advertisement, because I mean Joseph already talked extensively on this one. So basically, it's the idea that you can probe lighter dark matter, sub-GV dark matter, by looking at inelastic scattering. So the idea is that you have like dark matter particle scattering of a nucleus, and then you produce a photon. And by doing that, parametrically, you can actually access much wider range in energy. So you can push the limits, as Joseph showed yesterday, in the sub-GV region. So I'm not going to spend more time on this one, because Joseph presented this very, very well. So I'm just going to move to the main topic that I wanted to discuss. And this is the sort of like a shadow effect of the Earth, and how this can actually help us probe new parameter space. So this is an old figure. This is a figure from an older paper. So limits have changed slightly since then. But this is a picture of, like, let's say, the usual spin-independent cross-section constraints as a function of the mass. And then these are like different experiments, LAX, CREST, etc., XQC, balloon experiments. And they show you like how you can exclude, actually, phase space here. The point, though, is that, as you know, once you go to sort of like light dark matter, and by light I mean like basically like sub-GV, so currently like below half GV, I mean, since CREST is putting the strictest limit right now. So if you're sitting somewhere here, you have access to sort of like a lot of like phase space, which in principle you could have like a dark matter particle that interacts strongly with nucleons, which means that it can actually scatter several times at the ground before it reaches the detector. And that is not excluded, in fact. I mean, there are also collider constraints, etc., somewhere up here, depending on the model that you have. But the idea is that there is a lot of like phase space here that is still allowed, actually. So this can be problematic, because there's a hole in the phase space where, in principle, underground experiments might be blind to this parameter space. And that is because if the cross-section is actually high enough, dark matter particles, by going through the Earth, might lose enough energy along these 2 kilometers before they reach the underground detectors And then they might not have enough energy actually to recoil. The point is that even if you wait for a long time and you increase the volume of your detector, etc., you still might not be able actually to sort of like probe this part of the phase space. So that means that in principle you have to put detectors in a shallow site or even in the surface. However, I mean, there was a reason why detectors were placed in deep sites in the first place, and that was because of the background. So an alternative idea of how to avoid actually this is by trying to observe a diurnal modulation in the dark matter signal. So I'll explain why this, where this comes from. In principle, I mean, this sort of like idea to sort of like try to see for this diurnal modulation signal is ideal for portable detectors like Dammick, for example, because they can be placed in different sort of like depths and also different latitudes. As I'm going to show you, it looks like that this effect is maximized in the southern hemisphere, so around like 43 degrees, so somewhere in Australia or Chile or Argentina. And the same effect actually can be probed by directional detectors, because it manifests itself as a top-down asymmetry. So you're going to have like more particles coming from the top than particles coming from the bottom. So why this is important? Well, for example, like take this model actually, which is the usual sort of like it's a very common like dark matter model of dark matter coupled to a dark photon, which mixes kinematically with a real photon. And then, in fact, there have been constraints on the dark matter electron cross-section as a function of the dark matter mass in the MEV region. However, the point is that you have to take into account this underground scatterings. And in fact, in this particular case, the dark matter nucleon interactions coming from this interaction here are important. And that sets sort of like an upper bound on the constraints. Okay, so this is what was mentioned also yesterday in the workshop. So we did a Monte Carlo, and so this is like the analytic sort of like result if you use like some stopic equations. Okay, I don't want to bother you with the details. But we also did a Monte Carlo, and it sees that more or less somewhere here is actually the limit that you can set with xenon. For Dammick, it looks like that the region is sort of like, it's very, very narrow. So either you take the Monte Carlo or the analytic one, it's a very, very tiny region actually you can exclude, simply because if you are below this point here, I mean, you don't have enough exposure to exclude this parameter space. If you're above, your particle interacts too strongly and basically cannot trigger the detector.
Before we move on, this parameter space, I would imagine that for any choice of the parameter you have in that Lagrangian, there are a lot of other constraints that kick in before this effect starts to
come. You mean here? Or like,
so that's the xenon 10 exclusion region, but that's already being covered by, say, the B factories or the direct surges for the dark photon.
Yeah, so there are some constraints actually from all kinds of things like invisible decays of the Higgs of B mesons, etc. But also these are quite model dependent, you know.
But that's what I'm wondering. If that's the Lagrangian, I don't see the way that parameter space will be open.
Well, it is open. I mean,
how does the mediator decay in this case? If it decays visibly, then that cross section. And if it decays invisibly, then the
bar surge. Yeah, so basically, I mean, the point is that, for example, okay, if you have like light mediators, if you take, for example, like the LHC constraints, these are completely gone, for example. I mean, or if you have like.
But they're not completely gone because they live, they're left bounds mm-hmm. on this. So the left bounds, for instance, will constrain the kinetic mixing parameter in a model independent way at the 10 to the minus 3 level in that mass range.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, so this part, so there might be some overlap actually, especially in this region here actually, but you cannot actually cover the whole space actually with check that actually.
Okay, I'm not surprised by that.
And this is just an example also. There are all kinds of models that. That's why I said that these are very model dependent actual constraints. So you know, I mean. Because you can have, like, for example, like leptophilic, or you can have like all kinds of things that.
Leptophilic matters. That's that's where all the bounds
and the part. I agree.
I mean, so this cross section is roughly correspond to the interaction of the strong and the weak interaction. Right? So that's already kind of that's a lot.
All right, so so let me just discuss about this diurnal modulation, actually, of the dark matter signal, okay? So there are three sources of this. One is the shadowing effect, which I'm going to discuss in more detail. There's also gravitational focusing, simply by the fact that, as the Earth rotates around its own axis, if dark matter particle actually has passed around the center of the Earth, there is a bit of gravitational focusing. So since the Earth rotates, I mean, that creates a focusing and defocusing, actually, of the dark matter density. So that creates a daily variation of the density and of course the flux, and also the rotational velocity of the Earth, which is it's a small effect. I mean, this is like a bit less than 1 kilometer per second, still, I mean, this component that is superimposed with the total velocity of the Earth in the galactic system creates a small sort of like daily variation. The shadowing effect is. Is this what I stand actually in this picture here? So this is the Earth rotating, and this is in fact the velocity of the Earth with respect to the rest frame of the galaxy. So you see there are more particles actually coming this way from the dark matter wing than the other way around. So now, if you choose, for example, like your detector, let's say here in Australia, as an example, okay, when your detector is actually sitting on this side, most of this bulk of the dark matter wing particles actually. Have to travel the whole diameter of the Earth to reach the detector. 12 hours later, I mean, when your detector is sitting here, this big flux of dark matter particles actually have to travel only a couple of kilometers. So this is the this is what creates actually this daily variation of the signal. So what we did actually with Ricardo and Brad de Kavanagh was to make the assumption and say, okay, let's suppose that we have some dark matter particle that has a probability of interacting with nucleons, let's say, of 10% as it goes underground. So we went through like all these sort of like contact interactions, and we figured out like what is the amount of modulation that you get if you make this assumption, and we solved this problem analytically. So this is how this modulation actually looks like. So you see, this is actually the minimum of the, as a function of time, the minimum of the signal. The red one is the maximum, so the maximum is spread to larger areas. The minimum is really like concentrated, in, as you can see, in the southern hemisphere. That's why I said that the effect is larger there. And you can see, for example, different sort of like types of interactions in the Grand Sasso location, or in the location of the Sabre experiment in Australia. So you see that if you assume that you have like a 10% probability of scattering, this is like for a half GeV particle actually. So it's not excluded by direct detection. You see that in Grand Sasso, you more or less have like a 20%, okay, it depends actually on the type of the interaction, but you can have like a modulation which is like 10-20%. You see, in Australia, the variation can be actually much larger, simply because of the fact that, like I showed you, I mean, the minimum is deeper over there. So, in this sort of like calculation in this paper with Ricardo and Bradley, we solved this analytically because, I mean, we were able actually to sort of like assume that okay, the dark matter particle scatters at most once underground before it reaches the detector. So either. It goes directly to the detector, or it scatters once before it gets to the detector. However, if you sort of like crank up the cross section, so you have like a higher cross section, you can actually start having like multiple scatterings, and of course it's very difficult to actually track an analytic solution. So what I did with my graduate student Timon was to write a code, do a simulation actually, on a supercomputer in Denmark. Where we basically we start shooting actually dark matter particles, okay? We take into account the profile and the composition of the Earth. You know, I can show you as an example, like this is a 10 picobar dark matter particle of half GeV scattering around, okay, until it gets out of the detector in, for example, in Australia. And here there is not very visible, actually, but there's a few thousand, actually, events. So the idea, so what we did, actually, we managed to make this work in the sense that we verified the results that we got analytically with Bradley and Ricardo in the sort of like single scattering regime. And then we sort of like increased the cross-section. And so by the way, Damascus stands for dark matter simulation code for underground scattering. So this is a code which is publicly available. So if you want to sort of like play with your own model and see like what happens if you sort of like increase the cross-section, you can just download it and play with that. So what you see here, this sort of like four benchmark points here are, this is like the 10% probability that I was discussing. This is a cross-section that corresponds on average to one scattering per crossing. So roughly speaking, this would correspond to a cross-section of like 10 to minus 36 square centimeters if you have like spin-independent interactions. This is like 10 scatterings on average, and this is like 50. So what you see actually is that once you sort of like start cranking up the cross-section, the variation in the distribution, actually the velocity distribution at the site of the detector start changing. And in fact, the first effect that you see is the deflection. So particles are deflected out of path because of scatterings, and they don't make it to the detector. However, if you increase even further the cross-section like here, you see that the effect is not only the fact that you start deflecting particles out of path, but you start decelerating particles, because you see it's actually more visible here that the sort of like the peak of this distribution is different than the peak of this distribution here. And the other feature is also that you start getting actually a lot of like particles with very, very low energy, which is it would be interesting to see like what are the prospects of like seeing such a tail. So these four benchmark points, okay, you can actually put them in a plot like this, and you can say, okay, what is the amount of like this modulation that you see, daily modulation, as a function of the latitude? So you, of course, you can see that the more scatterings you have, the higher is the modulation. And again, you see why Southern Hemisphere is doing better than the Northern one, because if you take the Australia one, you can see that you can get up to like 100% modulation for sort of like this. This is roughly like 10 to minus 35 or 34 square centimeters cross section, okay? On the contrast, in Grand Sasso, you get a bit lower, but it's not much lower, actually. So here is like 90%, here you get something 60%. So it still would be something that it could be quite visible. Let me just summarize here, actually, what I discussed. I discussed about the prospects of actually detecting bound dark matter. The problem with that is that you really need like detectors with very, very low energy threshold. But on the other hand, I mean, it can help with a neutrino flow problem. It can help with identifying actually the type of dark matter nuclear interaction. And it's actually a sort of like cross-section independent feature that is going to appear no matter what is the cross-section of your dark matter nucleon. I didn't discuss about this. I just saw the slide to advertise actually what Joseph talked yesterday. And the last part which I discussed was about this daily modulation. And I think this is quite important because maybe this is it could be the only way that we can actually probe phase space of light and strongly directing dark matter that deep sight detectors might be blind to that. And also, it might help checking the self-consistency of direct detection experiments. And that is because, you know, if you have enough cross-section, I mean, you should be able at some point to start seeing this daily modulation effect. In fact, gamma is about at the point that it should start seeing diurnal modulation based on the rotation, okay, even if the cross section is not so large. So that is actually a very distinct self-consistency check for all experiments that they see a positive signal. Okay, thanks. Yeah, but this is just an example, actually. You can choose the location. Yeah, exactly. Yes. So it's not. You don't have to choose Australia. I mean, you can choose. You can actually put the location of your detector.
How far is gamma really away? I mean, in terms of statistics, to exclude itself and.
No, it's not okay. So I think it's like an order of magnitude, and you know, maybe it was too harsh what I said. Okay, because one order of magnitude means actually, yeah, you know, 10 times more exposure, right? So that might not be easy, but it's an important effect because. There's no way out of this. You know, they see an annual modulation. If at some point they don't see, if they have enough statistics, the daily modulation, then they self-exclude themselves as a dark matter solution.
But they are looking for that.
They are looking for that. So they had some, a few years ago they had published some results, but at the time they were sort of like basically scratching their own sort of like favorite region.
Can you go back to the slide where you compare SASO with SASO?
This one or?
No, the previous one.
This one.
So you had the two?
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
I don't understand the behavior of the particle one.
Okay, which line?
The particle one, which is an answer in SASO and right in SASO and
the second line, if you want. So you mean, okay, so the times are not synchronized, okay? So if that's what you're asking, it's not the same time. We chose the time like arbitrarily, like for these plots, okay?
No, I don't. You see, the green line
yes.
has an answered effect in the southern hemisphere, as you explained, with respect to the
south. This one, here, yeah, okay. Yes.
But the purple line is inverse.
The purple line, yes. Yeah, so that has to do with, you see this, like this O1,
this is operators, not in the technical paper.
Exactly, yeah. So there are some operators that actually favor like forward scattering, some operators that favor like backward scattering, and for example, like the spin independent, which is sort of like very, very uniform, like distributed. So that plays a crucial effect on that because you know, if you like favor like backward scattering, you scatter once and then you can just get out of the earth right away. So this is why you don't expect to see. I mean, yeah, that's why you have like things that wherever like you have like a minimum here, you can actually have a positive thing here because for example, like sometimes you can get an enhancement effect because some particle actually can pass through your detector, but because you favor like backward scattering, it scatters backwards and then passes your detector. So you can get an enhancement actually.
So your modulation of the signal. And demonstrate the three effects, like the shadowing effect and the gravitational effect plus the rotational effect.
Yeah.
Could you please show that again?
So what?
You said the daily modulation signal can demonstrate these effects.
Yeah, this is what I saw. This is the daily modulation. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right.